Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Good, The Dad and The Ugly, the fatherhood podcast. I'm Seth, a new dad, and on each episode you'll hear me and my good pal Jamie,
hello,
who's also a new dad, as we chat with our special guest each month about everything that comes with modern day fatherhood. Along the way, you'll also get the latest highs and lows and thrills and spills as Jamie and I foray further into these unfamiliar, joyful and often choppy waters.
Choppy waters.
Choppy waters. Choppy waters. Choppy waters. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of The Good, The Dad and The Ugly. I'm Seth and I'm here with Jamie.
Hello.
Hi, Jay.
Hey.
How you doing?
All right. Yeah, not bad. Good.
Good. I'm obviously going to ask you plenty of questions about your new role as a dad.
Yeah.
But we'll introduce our guest for today first.
I think, yeah, good idea.
If you'll remember, in the last episode, it was just me and Jay in the studio for a special episode on the birth of Jamie and Nat's daughter Matilda. Mm. But this time you'll be happy to know we are back to the usual setup, which is the two of us plus a special guest. And we've got someone super special for you again today who I'm tremendously excited to introduce.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Jamie, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you?
Yeah, it's a solid 10.
Solid 10.
Yeah.
I'm going to go 11.
Yeah, I don't like it when people do that. Because that's okay. Like people going, I'll give it 110%. That's not actually possible.
That's true. But I mean, you know.
If it's good enough for Spinal Tap, then I guess, yeah, it's good enough
for
you.
All right, exactly. Cool. All right, I'm going to go ahead and introduce him now. It's a bit of a tall order. I have to say I was intimidated last time when we had the multi-talented Matt Willis on. But this month's guest is, I'm going to say, a modern-day Renaissance man. In addition to being a rapper and a songwriter, he is a screenwriter, an actor across various genres, TV drama, TV comedy, film, etc. He's also a stand-up comic, and something that's especially relevant for the pod, he's an author of a successful children's book, and of course he's a dad, and we just learned that he's a copyright for adverts as well, so a pretty impressive all-round guy. He is the one and only Ben Bailey-Smith, aka Doc Brown.
I just, when you said children's book writer, I just realized I totally forgot to, I meant to bring you guys copies.
We've got copies with us, don't worry.
Oh, have you?
Well, yeah.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh, bless you. I was going to give you freebies. Okay, that's great. Because, you know, there's no fucking money in children's picture books.
Oh, really?
unless you're Julia Donaldson, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
No, there's nothing. There's not a penny. I got my first check for I Am Bear, I don't know, probably 3 months after the hardback dropped last year, so probably around this time last year, and to this day I'm still in the minus of my advance. Like, I've got about 14 grand until I get into like the positive.
It's a bit, wow, like this podcast.
So that will surprise a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, that's because I would have thought that it's quite a lucrative.
Yeah,
it's really
like
not
a niche book.
It's really not. It only is if you've got a lot going on around the book. If you look at Julia Donaldson, she's number one. She's got about 25 books out, of varying quality, and and also she's got stage plays. She's got toys, big budget cartoon movie versions.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like, I talk to my sister about it all the time. My sister Zadie Smith, I'm sure everybody knows. Like, she's a successful novelist in a lot of people's eyes, but still, like, what do you do around a book? Like, that book could sell reasonably well, right? But if you've got a great book, that you tell me about a great book that you've read, I'm going to ask you to lend me it. Do you know what I mean? I might not go out and buy it. So you've got to have other ideas.
You think with children's books, you think, because like people are always so
people want new.
Of,
they want the new.
Exactly.
So but I'm like that with normal books as well. I don't like lending my books to anyone. I get really possessive over my books because I like them on my shelf.
You should, because they'll never come back.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Because you won't remember
no.
who you lent it out to.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of like, you know, your book, do you want to tell us a bit about, for people who maybe don't know about the book and what it is? And like, it's called Iron Bear.
Yes.
And it came out this year?
Well, the hardback came out first and then there's a year before the paperback. This is another thing that's just, I mean, this is based on some ancient thing in publishing where they used to bring out a hardback for schools and libraries because it was hard wearing and then they'd wait and then they put out this paperback for the shops, and for some reason we still do that, but it's nuts because the hardback is like $11.99. you know, who wants to spend £12 on a children's picture book? And then the paperback's nearly half that price, but you gotta wait a year for it to come out. So I don't understand any of that, but anyway, I Am Bear came out February 2016 in hardback. And it's basically like a short picture book for toddlers about a bear who's a prick. That's really all it is. You know, me and Sav Accused, my illustrator, we came into the game in a very strange way because authors and illustrators don't come together for picture books. Authors sign deals and publishers place illustrators with an author, established illustrators, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if Kanye made a trainer... made a sneaker for our American listeners. who would give a fuck? But if he does it with Adidas, then people are like, oh, it's the new Kanye Adidas thing. Because it's Adidas.
Yeah, of course.
Similarly, if I wrote a picture book and tried to draw the pictures myself, do you know what I mean? It would be shit, no matter how good the text was. And people would ignore it. Whereas if I had Quentin Blake and you walked into Waterstones and saw Quentin Blake, you might buy a David Walliams book if that's your thing.
I saw that actually when I went into the shop the other day. And I
what, has he got a Quentin Blake
illustrated? He's had some Blake illustrations. I think it's Tony Ross now who does his stuff. But Tony Ross is also a fucking legend.
Mm.
Tony Ross was working when we were babies. Do you know what I mean? So he's had two legends illustrating for him. And that is literally, it's like the Nike swoosh.
Yeah.
It's like the Adidas trifoil, you know, on your product. So it makes total sense. And me and Sav would like, I mean, I was thinking about writing a children's book because I just thought, I've read so much shit for my children when they're little. And I know I could do as good as some of these. Do you know what I mean? Not saying like, oh, I'm Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
I just thought, some of these are horse shit. There's no two ways about it. This is rubbish.
Do you want to name and shame any particular that you think has?
You know, it's hard to remember because my kids are 11 and 8 now.
Right.
And like, I Am Bear is for 2 to 5 year olds, really. Even maybe 1 year olds, you could read it to.
Yeah.
But it's for very little children. I just really remember from that era, like, there was stuff that I was just like, this is bollocks. Yeah. This is actually an affront to young children because there's just nothing there. And then you go, oh, you wrap up some rubbish little moral at the end, or, oh, now it's time to go to bed. What? You haven't earned anything. You haven't earned anything from me, like, you know? Or, I mean, the big ones are the ones that are just glitter. There's just glitter all over them and pink. Do you know what I mean? Oh, look, you got a daughter. Here you go, you fucking idiot. It's some glitter and some
it's
pink.
It's frozen, the book.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really resented that, and Sav did too.
Did you, like, because obviously the for people who don't know, the book is kind of written in sort of quite a lyrical way.
Yeah,
a bit like
and in the first person, it's from Bear's perspective.
And... but it, was that always the intention to sort of draw on your kind of like rap?
Yeah, but that wasn't my idea. That was Sav's.
Right.
I wanted to, like, if I could show you, I wish I brought some of them with me. If I could show you some of my other children's book ideas, they're so worthy. And they're like, there was one about a little mixed race girl who nobody liked because her hair was too curly. You know, it's just like, oh, fuck off, man. Yeah.
So there's no moral to Iron Bear, basically, is what you're
no,
saying.
No, that was all Sav's idea. Sav was like, let's just have him get away with it.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you can't really do that. And he was like, no, but look at it. You keep it so sparse that it becomes a conversation about morals between the reader and the child.
Mm.
And I was like, that's fucking genius.
Mm.
And that's what happens.
Yeah.
People tweet me every day, parents, going, ah, oh, it's so great because my kid always says, you know, ah, oh, it wasn't Squirrel that stole the donuts, it was Bear. Like, Bear should get punished. You know, and kids are coming up with these things on their own without being told. And in the end, Bear had to go to jail.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or like the books that I really hate where it's just like, and after that conversation, Susie was never selfish ever again for the rest of her life. It's like, what lesson is that for kids? Kids go into the playground the next day and someone's a selfish prick to them again. You know, someone gets away with murder in the playground every day. Teachers don't want to deal with it. So it was really, like I say, it mainly came from Sav, just that concept of, well, hold on, you know, bad people exist. People get away with naughty things.
Yeah.
But it's up to you how you live your life. You can watch someone doing a bad thing and they get away with it. Doesn't mean that you go, oh, well, he got away with it, so I'm just going to do this.
Yeah.
If you've been raised right, you look at him and go, it's quite funny that he got away with it. I personally wouldn't do that. And that's how the book's been received. And that, to me, is just unbelievable. Like, I'm so proud of that. But I don't, yeah, like I said, I don't make a penny out of it. In the early stages, I was going back to my mum's house and going into the attic and pulling out books that I vaguely remembered from when I was a child and testing them on my kids and seeing if they still had weight. And the great books are timeless.
Which really are.
I mean, in terms of like absolute minimalism for a very young age, Rosie's Walk is fucking unreal. There's not even any words. It's just a chicken walking home. No words, just pictures. And it's pure slapstick comedy. It's incredible. And it's about 40 years old.
Oh, okay.
And it is timeless. I mean, if you've got toddlers, they'll love Rosie's Walk. They'll laugh. And you can tell your own story. There's no words.
Mm.
I mean, it's special. There's another book called Hug, which is a lot newer, probably 10 years old, maybe. I think that's Jez Albra.
Right.
I might be wrong. So someone will be listening going, no, it's not fucking Jez Albra. But it's just a little monkey who loses his mum, and it's the usual journey. Have you seen my mum? Have you seen my mum? The pattern of children's books, picture books.
Does he find his mum?
He finds his mum. Spoiler alert. But there's only one word in that, which is hug.
Okay.
So everywhere he goes, he just goes, hug? Question mark. Okay. And the animals are like, we're not the guys. We'll give you a hug, but we're not the guys you want the hug from, you know. It's beautiful, but it's just one word, hug, and the story's called Hug. Here's a nerdy dad story. I was in a National Trust ruined castle. I can't remember where it was, actually. We were just stopping off somewhere on a bit of a... We like to do like big, long family drives. And you know how your kids, they love the shop at the end. They love the fucking shop.
Yeah.
So you have to go through the shop. And then, oh, daddy, can I have this? No, you're going to fucking lose it before you even get home. Do you know what I mean? But you got to give them like a fiver or whatever, or a couple of quid and see what. I'm walking through this shop and there's a table covered in one picture book. Just stacked up, displayed out, fanned out across the table.
Yeah.
And I picked it up and I leafed through it and I actually started crying. Now, this will be strange to listeners who don't know me, but to anybody who's got children, they'll know, like, tears are never that far away. Like, before I had kids, I remembered the last time I cried, like, two times. One was when, at my dad's funeral. And the other one was like when I was like fucking 12 and I like slipped on a curb, gashed my knee quite badly and it hurt. So I cried. Other than that, I couldn't remember when I cried. And like since I had kids, I cry at all types of shit. You're just uber emotional. So the book was this book called Apple Pigs, which the National Trust had obviously taken over the rights to.
Yeah.
And I'd not seen it since... You know, probably 1981 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just looked at the cover and I was like, I fucking know this. But I was just on my own with it. It was just like, I was in the zone. I know this. And I opened it. Every page I remembered. It was just this girl, she planted some apple seeds from an apple and the apple tree was just barren every year. And it just really depressed her as a little kid. And she hit like the end of childhood, sort of like 11, 12. And the apple tree just suddenly grows, but the apples do not stop coming. And she just does everything with the apples, including turning them into little apple pigs. Like, she molds apple pigs out of them, which is where the title comes from. But there's so many apples that they feed the whole neighborhood, and people come around. She's got a million ideas for these apples, and she's just overwhelmed with happiness. And I leafed through it, and I cried like a bitch in a National Trust shop. Yeah? If anyone walked in at that moment, I went, isn't that Doc Brown? I would have been fucked. Like, that would have been the end of my career.
That's probably quite
right there.
Right, at the National Trust.
Yeah, like, that's a safe haven for me. Yeah. I don't get spotted. like, I'm running out of safe havens. I've got two Instagrams. I've got, like, my public one.
Yeah.
I don't put my kids on there.
Yeah.
And I've got my private one, which I do put my kids on.
Yeah.
And I Glastonbury'd the shit out of that with my kid. Hey, I'm the coolest dad on here, all right? Look at my kids. They're watching Chic. Where are your kids?
Is that the first? Have you taken to a festival before? Is that your first?
No, I always took them to Latitude when they were younger.
How old were we talking when they were young?
My youngest, she was 9 months, I think.
Ooh,
I
mean, okay.
First time she went to Latitude. That's pretty young.
Yeah.
It was a ball ache, yeah. Oh. I wouldn't recommend it.
Oh,
like, okay. And I purposely never took him to Glastonbury. I took him to the smaller ones. Like I say, started with Latitude, worked my way up a bit.
How big?
I didn't bring him to Glastonbury until last year was the first time. They've only been to two Glastonburys, and I've been since 95.
Yeah. Yeah, Glastonbury's a different ball game, though, I think.
It's more fun when they're older. Like, you know, like, my kids have talked about Glastonbury since 2016 Glastonbury. Do you know what I'm saying? Talked about 2017 Glastonbury and wanting to go. And, you know, like, they see a whole different Glastonbury. And I have to say, I saw a whole different Glastonbury in 2016 because I was sober a lot more of the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's actually a beautiful side to this festival that I've always been too high to notice.
Yeah. there's loads of, like, kid stuff.
The kids feels out of this world. I mean, in 2016, it was a washout, right?
Yeah. Right,
and I was there for 3 days. And it was hard work. Just moving around was hard work.
Yeah.
Watching shows was not enjoyable. Like, stomping around in really deep mud, horrible. But the kids' field was the nicest ground in the whole festival. So, you know, I spent a shitload of time in there.
Have you performed at Glastonbury before?
I always perform. That's why I go. I wouldn't pay to get in.
Oh, right.
Like, for all my family of four, that's just going to cost you a grand.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
What were you performing? Were you doing
always comedy. Yeah, they don't. I'm not trusted to do serious music there. People don't really trust in me to do serious music, which is frustrating because I was a serious musician for a lot longer than I've been a comic. But there we go. I can't control that.
You've just got a new album earlier this year.
Yeah.
Stemma.
Mm.
Tom kind of elaborated a little bit on what Stemma actually means, but what is it?
It was a word I stumbled across in a book that I just really loved. Like, it's my thing, like, reading books and finding words. I immediately look them up. It's the only thing I liked about the Kindle. I'm back to books now, but what I loved about the Kindle was the way you could just press the word and it defined it.
Yeah.
I think that's an amazing little feature. So I think I was reading the Biography of London by Peter Ackroyd, which is just an absolute beast, like 1,100 pages.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I read the word. It was something historical anyway, and the word popped up as a kind of old school Latin word that basically means, like, the genealogy of a family tree.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it also has a secondary meaning, which a lot of words do, which is how transcript connects, how words and phrases within a script connect to each other.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, fuck, that's perfect. Because I'd been, like, I was about halfway through the album when I found the name. And I'd been writing songs about sins of the father, about parenthood, about, you know, nature or nurture, about whether you can blame your behavior on people in your family before you or whether it's just you.
Yeah.
But then also, I'm writing script, I'm writing verse. So I was just like, it couldn't be a more perfect name. Welcome to the real, you can feel it in an eavesdrop. Trying to give my children something to believe in. Trying to bring a little sunshine to Neasden, Wilsdon, Dollis Hill, Kilburn, I'm on it still. And the roads I left behind, you'll be on my will. Incredibly, you're still the source of my energy. Bodies turn to dust, but the flow will never rest in peace. I got my daughters looking up right next to me. And this is Stemma, the beginning and the end of me. So family seems to be something that's kind of, you keep kind of coming back to in pretty much it's huge
everything
for me,
you do, right?
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. And parenthood, like being a father, was something I always wanted to do as well from when I was an actual child, which I think is unusual for boys.
Yeah.
Someone tweeted something amazing a couple of weeks ago that fucking blew me away. Some girl tweeted, a young girl as well, she tweeted that the reason that girls mature quicker than boys is because they are forced to be responsible for their actions and nurture from the start. Mm. I mean, she did put it in way better and more aggressive terms than that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was, in a nutshell, it was brilliant, but it really made me think, fuck, that's so true. You know, most boys just kick around, do dumb shit, and everyone goes, oh, boys will be boys, you know?
Mm.
Whereas a lot of people will say, no, boys will be held fucking responsible for their actions. I was raised by women, and I just always, I'm not trying to call myself like some maternal guy, but I just made a decision early on. I wanted to have kids. So deep down, I always knew that if I met the right girl, I would just hope that she would felt the same. And I was very fortunate in that respect. She felt exactly the same. She was desperate to have kids. So we just went for it, even though we were, in the modern age standards, young. Do you know what I mean?
Which was how old were
you? Like mid-20s, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the old days, that would have been considered old, I think. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But in 2017, that's quite young.
It is.
And so you have two girls.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard you say, I wrote it down actually. I thought it was like, you said kids teach a man how to love.
Yes, like, they do.
Like, explain. I thought that was really interesting.
There's a lot of levels to it. First off, I would not deny any of my own misogyny or my own suspect gender politics or sexism that I think are rife amongst just the male population.
Mm.
But only so far as you choose to challenge them. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you choose to challenge them, then you can be whatever you want to be to whoever you want to be. It's just a question of how much you can be fucking bothered. And most men can't be bothered.
Mm.
Whereas if you sire, can you say sire? Yeah. If you sire girls, you're forced to think about it. No matter how, what kind of dickhead you are, you're forced to think about it.
Yeah.
And the real dickheads go, I don't want to think about it. And they just run away, which is why you have so many, you know, single parent situations. I was never going to do that. So I had to face my own demons and work out what it was in me that sort of secretly, privately felt that, well, I'm a man, so I'm good. Do you know what I mean? I had to question that. And you have to question a lot of things. You have to question your pornography use. You have to question, like,
I guess your language, your use of
your
words.
Language. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, the stuff you... It's like when you get your first gay friend.
Mm.
And you're like, oh, man. Like, I grew up saying if something was rubbish, I'd say it was gay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's the first time you go, oh, fuck. Like, actually, that's yeah, so dark to yeah, say that. Do you know what I'm saying? And, you know, if these things can force an undereducated mind like myself to learn and realign myself to a point where I'm totally okay with it, then anyone can do it. And it's inexcusable to not do it.
Mm.
So now I spot the subtleties of sexism in a way that I've always spotted the subtleties of racism.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying I'm on the same level as women, because I could never be. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. All I know is my radar's up for that shit.
So you think then you're like probably quite a different person because you've had two girls?
I wouldn't say I'm a different person. I'm the same prick I always was. But I'm definitely more rounded.
Right, yeah.
I'm more rounded. I'm more emotional. I'm more in touch with my feminine side, because I started realizing that every human being does have both sides.
Yeah.
It's just chance that you got the chromosomes you got. It's just pure chance. You know, before those chromosomes hit, you could have been either, and like every single person's got some sexual fluidity, some gender fluidity on an emotional level. I think that's one thing I've discovered over time. I'm not saying I definitely want to suck cocks. I'm not saying that.
For the record.
Yeah, I'm good. But I'm also, like, I am saying there's a part of me that's like, fuck, I recognize these elements of me that as a teenage boy, I would have gone, no, no, I don't care. What are you talking about? Do you know what I mean? You fight it because you think that's the manly thing to do.
We're brought up like by society to kind of feel like that we have to conform to a certain stereotype.
Of course. And the concept of being manly itself is like, it's bullshit. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the manly thing to do when I was 18, 19 and people were making their girlfriends pregnant, the manly thing to do in their eyes was to just fuck them off and go off and be a manly man somewhere else.
Right, yeah.
And maybe get another girl pregnant or at least just keep fucking different girls. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? That was the manly thing to do. Whereas now you would recognize the manly thing to do is be a fucking man and be a father to your kids.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not going to say like I'm the perfect father. I'm far from it. But I think I'm an interesting father.
Would you say you think your kids think you're cool? Because not a lot of people do. We've spoken to quite a lot of people and they don't.
No, they don't think I'm cool. What they think is the trappings of my work can lead to cool shit for them.
Right.
There's a crucial difference.
Yeah.
So, for example, my 11-year-old, when I talk to her when her friends are around... It's like how we used to react when like the community police officer came up to us when we was in a stood around like having a cypher when we were 16.
I am from the nerd squad.
Hey kids, I'm the new community police officer. Listen, I know a lot of the other police are on your back. My name's Martin. I'm here. You know, I used to listen to a bit of rap. I'm not, come on, I like a bit of rap as well, as much as the next man, yeah? So, you know, just saying I'm here.
And we'd all be just looking at our fucking feet, you know? It's kind of like that with my eldest. So we got a cool relationship, but when she's with her girlfriends, nah, man. Like, I think her girlfriends kind of think I'm a goof and they quite like me goofing around. But yeah, I can feel the beginnings. Like in a year and a half, 2 years, my eldest would be a teenager. And I can feel the beginnings of it happening now. Where it's kind of a bit... I'm not getting involved, by the way, in the secondary school process. This is an interesting conversation point, actually. Because my eldest is going to secondary school in September.
Right.
And I'm not getting involved. I was deeply involved in helping her decide what school she's going to. But in the early stages, when she starts, I'm not going to be around at all.
Why is that?
I'll be here physically for her when she comes home from school. Because I noticed something fucked up. I changed her school about 3 years ago. And at that time, and still today, I was and am the creator and former star of one of the most successful CBBC shows of all time.
Yep.
The 4 o'clock club.
Mm.
And I can't fuck around. I can't be near schools, even secondary schools, because kids grew up on my shit. And one thing we noticed that was quite dark, when she changed primary schools a couple years ago, she came to me and she said, I don't know if I like this girl or not. Because I said, this girl seems really friendly. You could be friends with her. And she said, I don't know if I like her or not. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, all she does is ask me about you.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, that's fucked up.
Yeah.
And it's because she'd seen me.
Yeah.
So she wanted to be friends with her because of me. And my daughter's savvy enough to bat that off and that they are not friends. She's got her own group of friends who are real friends now and they're not impressed by me. Like I say, they think I'm a goof. But I don't want to risk that again in year seven.
Mm.
It's a bad starting point, I think, for her.
That's funny that, because when I was a kid, and I think back to shows that I watched, I don't think I had like that. Like, I would be interested in the show, but it wouldn't go beyond.
It's different
like,
age, though, isn't it? Mm, I didn't care either. I didn't care about the world beyond the show.
Yeah. But it is a different
that's
age,
weird,
isn't it?
I'm
celebrity kind of like fascination.
Like, I follow Derek Griffiths on Twitter now, but I don't know if I would have cared back then.
Yeah.
I just loved the show as it was in that moment, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like, I mean, I guess there are some people who I imagine would probably quite like that kind of adoration, that kind of like they're being recognized. But then I guess when you're talking about like year sevens, it's kind of a little bit different.
I can't be near schools. I can't be near schools. I can't be near schools at 3:30.
Yeah, we should probably talk about, you know, 4 o'clock.
I can't be there.
Like that, so that was massively successful. You're now I think we were talking before, you've now passed that on
that's
to
right.
your brother.
My brother is writing all the songs for it.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the team of writers, of script writers that I was writing with in series one and two, are still on it. So there's a sort of continuous vibe to it, so to speak, and the cast keeps changing, which is fine because it's set in a school. But yeah, for the past, what were we on, series seven?
Mm.
The past two series, my brother's been writing all the songs, and it's beautiful to me because the show was about two brothers.
Yeah,
at the start, so it's quite nice that there's still a family connection behind the scenes as well as in the essence of the show.
I mean, it really is a huge, it's massive, isn't it?
It's gigantic. Yeah. I mean, like, it's just been commissioned for an eighth series. And there's not that many scripted series outside of soap operas on British television that have run for that long.
And for anyone who hasn't, I'm sure the majority of people who are listening to this will be aware of it through their kids. Like, what's the vibe? What is it?
It's the initial idea was based on my work before I got into this entertainment world. I was a youth worker and I worked in a series of youth clubs. I ended up running my own after school club, and it was based on those experiences because I was always very immature, so I still am, and it always just made me laugh that I'd meet kids all the time that were way wilier than me. And the most profound experiences came in the last club that I ran, which was for kids who were the children of asylum seekers or victims of wars, conflicts in other parts of the world. Some of which were unaccompanied minors, you know, like kids who had no parents who were settling in this one particular area not far from where I grew up. And I helped develop an after-school facility for those kids. And working with those kids and seeing them grow up, it was fascinating because they were immediately more mature than me. They'd seen fucking war. They'd seen people killed and shit. Do you know what I mean? And they weren't all damaged like you think. Oh, yeah, they're probably really damaged. No, kids are super resilient and they bounce back. So these are kids who came with not a word of English. Within 2 weeks, they've got like slang. Do you know what I mean? They've got English asides. Like, they're on some next level because kids are like that. They're like sponges. They're amazing, the ability. So it always just made me laugh that I'd be having like these man-to-mans with like 7-year-old Sudanese boys. And that's kind of where the idea came from. I wanted to make a show sort of based on that Homer-Bart dynamic where you've got an infantile man and a really sharp-witted child. And it was actually Paul Rose, a really experienced children's writer who'd written on Wolf Blood and Tracy Beaker and shit like that, who came up with the idea of making them brothers. My idea initially was just that they were a teacher and pupil who rubbed each other up the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, but he came up with the idea of them being brothers, and that gave it its heart, really. And it was a fascinating process because I was involved from the start, obviously, because it was my idea. I pitched it to CBBC. I'd managed the whole thing. I'd moved up to Manchester to live where CBBC had moved to at the time.
Right.
So I was involved hands-on with the casting, and initially we were looking for a boy who looked like me, and they had to come in and do some script reading with me and also perform a rap. We had some funny moments, actually. There's one fat kid who came in and he was like, I want to perform my own rap. And I was like, oh, amazing, great. And he was like, hey, yo, I got bitches in the back of the whip sucking my dick. And I was like, dude, you're 10 years old. Like, what the hell? But there was another, this other kid walked in and he looked nothing like me. He was dark skinned, glasses, precocious. He grew up in Peckham, but he lived in Sale now, outside of Manchester. And a grammar school kid. And he did the dialogue perfectly. He had so much character.
Yeah.
And then he said, I want to do my own rap as well. And I was like, fucking hell, here we go again. But it was amazing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I was like, oh my days, like it has to be him, even though he looks nothing like me.
Yeah.
And to this day, the number one question I get from younger kids is he really your brother? Do you know what I mean? And it's, do you know what I mean? It's like me and you being brothers. Like no one would have thought it on the street.
Yeah, yeah.
But something in the beauty and the wonder and the intelligence of his performance meant that he seemed like my brother. Mm. And I loved him like a brother.
Okay, that's at the end of part one. We'll be right back with the next part.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You've talked before about how sort of close you are with your sister, Zadie. Yeah. I guess what the, you know, with having two daughters, like how do they get on with each other? Do you kind of try and really make sure that they get on? Do you, with the value of sort of like a good sibling relationship?
Yeah, I think the sibling relationship is absolutely key on so many levels. I mean, the first thing for me and my sister was our colour. So like if you are a little kid, you might remember a day in school where you're at the lunch table and you all get your plastic cups and they're all different colours. And one of you says, anyone's got a red cups coming to my birthday, you know, or some shit like that. You sort of, you bunch together in what is familiar, right? It's nothing to do with racism. It's just familiarity, coziness and warmth. If you're in an all white family or an all black family or an all Indian family, or an all Chinese family, everybody looks the same. You're on the same team from the start. In a mixed race household, it's slightly different because we had a white father that we didn't look anything like, and we had a black mother that we didn't look anything like. So at a very, very early age as a mixed race kid, you're like, not even who am I? Like, you're like, what am I? Like, what am I? Like, because you go to other kids' houses and they all look like their parents. And you're like, what? I don't get it. So your sibling becomes immediately important in that area. And then the other thing is, you know, there's only 18 months between me and Zadie. So we grew up kind of like twins, you know, we had the double buggy and shit. So, you know, we were very, very close as youngsters. And then by the time we reached sort of like seven or eight, or she reached seven or eight, I should say, it became quite clear that she had abnormal brain power. Because our reading was at a par and then everything changed.
Yeah.
So she was reading like Judy Blume and then she'd give me the Judy Blumes. And I'd take way longer to get through like Super Fudge, you know. Take the whole summer like reading this book like about a child's summer. I'm reading it in fucking real time. Do you know what I mean? And she's just flying through them and then going up and up and up. To the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And then when she read Little Women in like 2 days, that's when everybody was like,
whoa,
okay, this is weird now.
Yeah.
And then she started trying to write.
Wow.
At eight?
Yeah. That year she came second in like a national competition. She saw an advert from Smarties saying they'd linked up with this character from children's TV called Dr. Smarty Pants.
Okay.
Who was actually, funnily enough, children's book fans, Michael Rosen. It was like a character he played on TV in the 80s. And Dr. Smarty Pants was looking for the smartest writer for the National Smarties Writing Competition. And she wrote a story. You know, and these are the days when that shit was big. Do you know what I mean? You know, like you hear these terrible things about Blue Peter getting no viewers and stuff. Mm. Back in the day, you have to understand, these things were huge. Panini stickers, send-off competitions, get a fucking spoon from Frosties. This shit was huge.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't that much entertainment. Kids have got too much entertainment now.
Yeah.
So she entered the competition and she came second. And she was in the national papers and whatnot.
Shit.
And that was it. That's where it started. And from there, she just kept winning writing competitions, man. Like, when she was like 14 or 15, she won a competition to be the editor of one issue of Just 17. Wow. Which was like a huge magazine.
I remember that magazine.
Huge magazine. Do you know what I'm saying? She did that, nailed it. Then, like, first year of university, she was already published in like a book of short stories. She had a short story in there. And then by her graduate year, she'd written one chapter of White Teeth and got a deal with Penguin at Random House. End of story.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So like she
makes me feel like that small.
Yeah. She was a prodigy, and I knew that from the start. And as her intelligence grew and I realized she was like a kind of superhero, I think we sort of distanced a little bit, but we always had that kind of Luke and Leia kind of connection.
Did you feel like, whatever, Leia, hear
me. Do you know what I mean? She knows what I'm thinking and feeling. That's like some twin shit.
Yeah.
Did you feel like an immense amount of like pressure then to kind of live up to that?
No, not at all, because we were in a working class household with parents who were not academics, they didn't even finish school. Do you know what I mean? There was never any pressure on us to do anything of any, you know, academic or global value. Do you know what I mean? It was always just morals. Just don't be a dick to people. Right. Do you know what I mean? That was it. And when we showed interest in something, my parents were very encouraging.
Mm.
And all my parenting skills come from that. Like, I don't want to force anything on my kids. I want them to come to me with a passion, and I'm going to facilitate that as much as I can.
Yeah.
And that's what our parents did, with no connections, no old money, no nothing.
Mm.
My sister, in fact, at one point became the breadwinner of the entire family at 21. I mean, it's fucking insane.
Yeah.
So do your daughters, are they pretty close? Do you kind of like...
each other?
Yeah.
Yeah, massively. Obviously, they fight, you know, hammer and tongs, but when they're out of the house, you just see them. They just fight for each other because it's the wider world and it's scary, you know? In the house, it's like it's all power struggles.
Yeah, yeah.
But outside of the house, it's just like it's you and me and this fucking crazy thing. And it's a scary world.
Yeah.
I mean, they're growing up in a time that very much reminds me of when I was their age, where we had a fucking relentlessly evil, racist, classist Tory government and hardcore terrorism, worse than what we're getting in the UK now. People forget that. I'm not belittling the terrorist attacks in Manchester and all of that. It's fucking horrific. But just try and cast your mind back, if you're old enough, to when I was a little kid in the early 80s. The IRA shit was nuts, man. Yeah, like, man. And I was living in Kilburn, where a lot of them were hiding out and shit. You know, you were scared because it was in the news every day. And, you know, my kids, they're terrified of terrorism.
Mm.
Absolutely terrified. It keeps them up at night.
Okay.
How do you deal with that? Like, what's your kind of... Because, I mean, that's something
I've
thought
really,
about.
It's really, really tough. And it brings me to tears quite regularly because I can't control it. I can't control terrorism. I can't control... this level of I don't want to say evil, because I hate it when people say evil. Terrorists are normal people with mental problems.
Mm.
That's what you never hear about. All you hear is like, he's evil. How did he get radicalized?
Mm.
Mate, he's a fucking nutcase. If he thinks it's okay to kill someone for what he believes in, mate, if I thought that was okay, there would be anytime someone said Tribal Quest, they're not all that. They'd be dead. They would be dead. Do you know what I'm saying? They'd be dead. You have to be mentally ill to kill someone for something that you believe in.
Yeah.
Like, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
And it's a hard thing to explain to little kids.
Mm.
So, you know, the monster rhetoric, the evil rhetoric that you get in the press, I guess that's a bit simpler, but I don't like to be simple with my kids. I like to be quite real with them. And I give them the harsh reality quite a lot. And to be fair, my wife's on board with that as well. And neither of us had the most straightforward or simplest of upbringings. My wife's way, way tougher than mine, you know? So we're very much like, these are the realities of life, but there will always be helpers. There will always be people, good people that you can turn to that will look after you. And there will always be love and there will always be happiness in the world. And the fear and the horror, it doesn't last. It doesn't last. It doesn't last. It's always like some temporary shit that someone's trying to throw out there to make a statement.
Mm.
And it's petty.
Yeah.
Whereas love and happiness, togetherness, that shit lasts forever.
No, I just wanted to ask a question about storytelling and the role it has for kids. Because like you describe yourself as, you know, being a storyteller. That's kind of one of the main things you do. And obviously, you know, your sister is very much a storyteller and your brother too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you see storytelling like in terms of childhood?
Well, I guess as a precursor to this answer, I should also say I have a half-brother and a half-sister too, who are both artists as well. My other sister teaches art and paints herself, and my other brother is a musician. So we do sometimes think, like, what's the deal?
Yeah.
Because none of our parents are artistic, none of our parents are professional storytellers, none of our parents are connected to entertainment or anything like that. So what's the deal? How did it work? All I can think is that when I look back on my childhood, my parents just pulled out every stop. Like, they fucking did not drop the ball at any moment. Even when their marriage was in tatters, even when there was no money, even when there was outside stress, pressures pushing down on them, they just did not drop the ball with parenting. Right, they were on it at all times. I learned so much from them, you know, and it makes me laugh now when I speak to my friends, because I'm the first out of all my friends to have kids, and you know, my friends are having babies now, and it just makes me laugh for the ones that haven't, who are like, yeah. And I'm like, mate, you've been with your girl for ages. Like, what are you doing? Yeah, we're just looking for the... We just want to... I need to get the right job and need to get this house. And, you know, we want to be in this area and we need to be by this school. And like, mate, none of that shit's going to ever fucking happen. If I thought those things, I would never have had children. I wouldn't have even begun.
Mm.
And I think similarly, even though maybe that world of things of, like, I don't know, money pressures and stuff was maybe a little more straightforward than the years before I was born, I think my parents had similar pressures and they just fucking went for it. And they just thought, we've got something to give. And what they learned very quickly was, oh my God, we're up against it.
Yeah. Mm.
We're poor. We're not just black. We're black and white, which, you know, in America and in South Africa at certain times, being mixed race was at one notch above in the caste system. That didn't happen over here in the late 70s, early 80s. The probably the most hated, the most reviled, the most, like, just the horriblest thing was like a mixed family, because the racial tensions were so strong. You had the rise of the far right, thanks to some politics that are very reminiscent of what we're experiencing right now. But you also had, as a result of that, the rise of the Black Power movement.
Yeah.
You know, and the Back to Africa shit. You know, I think my parents were parenting under intense pressure.
Yeah.
Plus, don't forget, we were living in Kilburn on a council estate in an area that was largely Irish, that police would run through all the time, arresting and beating up innocent Irish dudes because they considered them to be IRA. And all our friends were Irish. So we were experiencing so much of this shit, so much negativity, and I didn't feel any of it. I never felt poor. I never felt discriminated against. I never felt under pressure. I never felt a right-wing influence. I never felt a prejudice, destructive, austerity-laden government. I never felt any of that shit.
Mm.
I was just bouncing around Queen's Park going, oh, look at that flower. Look at that butterfly. And my mum would dig up into the ground until she found clay, and we'd fucking put it, mold it and put it in the oven and make like welly boots and ashtrays. You know what I'm saying? So and they would both read amazing stories to us at nighttime and cuddle us and tickle us and sing to us. They were amazing people against all odds. And on top of that, you know, my father was born in 1925. He was on the beaches in Normandy in 1944. He killed men by the time he was 19, renounced violence, gave away all his medals and his uniform in the immediate aftermath of the war, fought for peace, met a black woman 30 years his junior in the early 70s, fell in love with her. She's fresh off the boat from Jamaica. They become the oddest couple ever and then have to force to fight immediate discrimination, yeah, not just from the rest of the world, the rest of the UK, but also from within their both their own families. So, you know, they could have been victims, but they ruled with love. They thought that was the stronger thing. And when I think of the madness that was around us as little children that I never felt ever, and then understanding it as we got older, I always think, well, what the fuck else would we have been but artists? Mm. You know? We were always going to be storytellers.
Yeah.
We were born to take our parents' struggle and move it into a way more middle class, comfy, cozy zone. Now, our biggest concern for myself and my sister, my younger brother doesn't have kids yet, but my sister's got two kids. Our biggest concern is how do we make our kids not pricks? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because we give them the world. We give them everything. We take them around the world. We, you know, we fly from country to country. You know, my only holiday was Cornwall. That was my holiday. Do you know what I'm saying? Cornwall. Mm. Where you just go from some racism in Kilburn to even more racism in Cornwall. Great. My eldest daughter's passport, we were gutted. She had to change it recently, you know, to renew it. Her old passport's fucking out of this world. She's been everywhere. And, you know, how do you make your kids keep not grounded, spoiled? Yeah. How do you, you know, because you want to give them everything. Of course you do. I want to give them everything and I want to make them feel safe in the face of darkness in the same way that my parents did.
Mm.
But I think I've got more resources than my parents had to do that.
Mm. Yeah.
That's pretty deep. In terms of, you know, storytelling, that whether it be writing humorous lines for your raps or coming up with a joke, where do you start with that? Where does that, does that come from personal experiences, or does that, do you just think of something quite funny and then like back?
Yeah, I start 100% with the truth, and then I work my way from there,
mm,
and then I'll break it down and find the funny within it. So everything changed in my career in stand up when I chose to do that. Before that, I was always like, what's the funny thing to say? And then I realized, actually, this is bullshit. I don't want to do this every night. I want to talk about the shit that's interesting to me. And then I was thinking, but yeah, but the shit that's interesting to me is not funny. And I thought, it doesn't have to be not funny. Find the funny within it. And that changed everything. And now I won't even do stand up if I don't feel like I'm saying something that's important to me.
Yeah.
People are like, do the tea song. Do fuck the tea song. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't even drink tea.
Yeah.
That's the thing that, like, if I could explain behind the curtain of stand up, I don't even drink tea.
That's so many illusions.
Yeah, that should let you know exactly what that kind of stand up is all about.
Yeah.
It's just like, here's a thing that everybody finds funny or has an opinion on. I'll poo poo it or I'll have a strong opinion about it. Yeah. That is stand-up 101. It's basic and it's bullshit. I'm not saying the tea song's not funny. It is. But who gives a fuck? Like, who cares? I don't even drink tea. I drink beer.
I came up with a joke the other day, and it's the first time it's ever, I was just sitting there, an advert came on, and then I went quiet for about 15 minutes trying to work this joke around. And I've tried it out on some mates, and none of them find it funny. But I think it's quite genius. And okay. You actually helped, Seth, you helped out on it, like towards the end of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Break
yeah.
it down.
Right, okay, so, okay, I've got to remember because it's quite it's quite long-winded. But what's the most confused piece of salad during Brexit?
The most confused piece of salad?
During Brexit.
Okay, the setup's not good.
No, I know, that's the problem. So
it's clunky.
Yeah.
But I feel like the punchline's good.
Mm. Romaine leaves.
That's good. Yeah. See, that's a good punchline.
It is, yeah.
yeah, it's good.
But the setup doesn't work at all.
That's the thing. That's why it took me like 15, 20 minutes to work out. Because I saw an advert for romaine lettuce and I thought, oh, romaine, that's a bit like... And then romaine... And then I said romaine leaf and then you came in with, it should be romaine leaves. And then we had the joke, but I haven't worked out.
Why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
Exactly.
No, it's good. You just need a comic, a true comic to...
Well, this is why
you're trying to say that James is not a true comic.
No, no. A true comic wouldn't have had that setup. Right, the setup's awful.
So what?
But the punchline's great.
So you'll probably
there's
do it a lot
good setup
quicker.
There, it just you just need to spend some time on it.
Yeah, I don't think I can be bothered. I don't.
Well,
think
in that case,
thing.
I might steal it.
Yeah, you can have it. You can definitely have it.
Like Jay was, it was actually in kind of behind the scenes life of this podcast not that long ago that we recorded the last bit of the episode. Maybe I shouldn't spoil the illusion, but what has actually been going on since?
Do you know what? People say parenting's hard. So far, it's been
breezy.
Yeah, I think so. I'm joking, obviously, but like she's sleeping, like I know. See, I'm getting
It just doesn't last, bro.
No,
it's
I know,
like
yeah.
phases. You know when? Because I remember these phases in the first year of my 11-year-old, but then after about when she was about 2.5, she really started to struggle to get to sleep. Because when they become aware of the world, that's when it becomes difficult to get them to bed. Mm. And if they're overly attached to you, it is important. Like, where does your daughter sleep?
In our bedroom.
There you go.
Yeah.
Number one, this is the first horrible situation that you've got. She sleeps perfectly in the knowledge that milk and love and comfort is right there.
Yeah.
You take that away from her, you're going to have your first major challenge when it comes to sleep.
Mm.
Right? And as soon as we experienced that, we struggled to get it back again. And it intensified as she hit 2. And then the next time that she properly slept all the way through the night, went to bed at the time we wanted her to go to bed without any emotional strain or grief or terrible trying on our senses was when she was about 8.5.
Okay.
Fucking hell.
Jesus.
So you could have...
Enjoy it while
it
lasts.
Years. Yeah. You could have 8 years of hell from now.
I'm waiting for it to change. Because like,
that's what I had.
Yeah, okay. Right, that's...
The second one,
that's
though...
That's sobering.
The second one, she just fucking sleeps.
Yeah.
From the day she was born to now. I mean, she didn't cry when she was born.
Right, okay.
I still can't get my head around that.
Yeah.
And she just sleeps. Mm. She loves to go to bed and she hates waking up.
That's
she
exactly
would,
the
she
same
would as, sleep yeah. in, until 10 if she could.
Yeah.
But she obviously has to go to school. But yeah, the eight-year-old has always slept.
Yeah.
The 11-year-old, even now, even last night, she had trouble sleeping. Mm. But 8 was the breakthrough when we were like, this has to... Like, we were going fucking insane.
Yeah.
We saw sleep specialists and stuff. And it was when we were like, at the end of our tether and talking about going to see like doctors... She freaked out and she was like, oh, I'll sleep. And she sort of forced herself to. But she still has trouble every now and again. Whereas the little one, never.
Yeah.
Never.
See, with Matilda, we've got to the stage where, like, unfortunately, she lost, like, in the first 4 days, she lost like 13% of her body weight, which was a big
deal. She was sick.
What was happening was, and it's still the case, we don't think she's, in terms of feeding, she's not really getting much from breastfeeding. Like, she's doing it all. She's, like, latching fine. She's on there for ages. But we think she's just, like, a really lazy eater.
How big are your wife's boobs?
Yeah, I mean, they're bigger now than...
That's literally nothing to do with me. I'm just literally trying to sneak in a... makes no difference, guys.
Yeah, well, that's... Well, I mean, she's... it's tough because like obviously Nat's going a bit crazy because it's sort of, you know, it's not really happening in that way. So we're having to use a bit of formula to kind of like top up, which isn't really what we want to do and blah, blah. But honestly, she sleeps and we have to wake her up in the middle of the night at like 3 a.m.
Make sure she's still alive. Like.
Well, just to kind of feed her, really. Just to kind of keep her going. I had this situation where I couldn't wake her and she was... Like, we knew she was alive, so it's fine. Like, because she was, like, doing the proper... Like, you know when you try and wake someone up and they just don't want to be woken up and they're just kind of going... Fuck off, sort of thing.
Yeah.
She was doing all of that. So I stripped her down, changed her nappy... I googled it and it said run ice cubes up and down her back. So I did that and I felt so bad
doing
that.
Let her sleep, man.
I did it.
Let her
sleep. Still slept through it. I'm telling you, man. She takes it off to her mum.
Let her sleep. If a baby, all they know is survival.
Yeah.
If she needs to eat, she will wake up and scream.
Yeah.
If she's sleeping, let her sleep.
Yeah, that's what we're doing now.
Get your rest. She'll be fine.
Yeah.
She'll be absolutely fine. Yeah. She'll eat when she has to eat.
I'm feeling quite smug because loads of people are texting me, being like, "Oh, how's it going? Are you sleep deprived?"
People always say that shit.
But do you want like new dads or new mums? And I know they're asking me so that they can laugh about it and be like, hey, "Well, it's going to continue." And I'm there going, "Nah, it's all right. I'm sleeping all the way through. It's fine." It's
but
like,
you know, sleep is the thing that is talked about most in the early years because it's the thing that affects you most intensely. But really, over time. It's an irrelevance. It's all about the emotions of your daughter or your son. That's the thing that people say, oh, it's cool. Now you got 11-year-old, 8-year-old, you don't have to worry about sleep. I still worry about sleep, not because my kids are going to wake up, but because I'm fucking terrified of everything. I'm anxious. I'm anxious about their well-being. I mean, I'm scared of the future. Mm-hmm. Before I had children, I didn't give a fuck about climate change. Climate change kissed my ass. It's going to happen. It's going to happen to some old dudes like long after I'm dead. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But now you have to worry about everything. And I mean, I sleep now like I slept when I had newborns. I sleep very lightly and I wake up or I can't get to sleep. And that's anxiety. It's the anxiety of being responsible for another person, another human being. You know, most of our friends, I'm sure, like, are not responsible for other human beings. Like, there's a lot of dudes who, like, you know, get to a point in a relationship with a chick and they're just like, I'm just sick of... like having to worry about like where she is, do you know what I mean? Or what she wants to do. So they call it off. We don't have that luxury. You can't call it off with children.
Yeah.
It's 24/7. The job ends when you die. Mm. That's when it ends. You know, and you pray that it's you that dies and not them. And then you got the underlying anxiety that it's maybe them that dies first. And these things are deep rooted and you don't want to address them, but they're there. They're there just scratching at the back of your mind. And that's the real reason you can't sleep. The fucking bottles and the formula and the nappies. It's just a front for what parenthood becomes. And
so if there's anyone out there who is thinking about having kids, that might...
Well, this is the thing. You've got to have both sides. Because the other side of it, which we've touched on already, is that it makes you, and I'm talking from a man's perspective, it makes you a fucking better man. I did not have this power of words. I did not have this sense of conviction. I did not have the success in my professional life. I did not have the ability to do what I do today before I had children. I was an underpaid youth worker when my first daughter was born. I got on stage for the first time and tried to do stand-up, which has led to all these amazing things that I've managed to do since and to a flourishing and financially stable career. I got on a stage to begin all of that at 30 years old with a toddler and a bun in the oven and no way of knowing how I was gonna pay the heating bills. Do you know what I'm saying? It was a different type of pressure. I had to be funny. I had to make it work. It was a huge gamble, but having the children forced me to say to myself, there's only one outcome.
Yeah.
It has to work. I'm not thinking about the other outcome. Whereas before that,
I'd be like, oh yeah, I'd quite like to do this, I'd quite like to do that, but I'd also like to play FIFA for a bit longer. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
completely.
So the negatives are profound and they are overpowering at times, but so are the positives. It's a completely even thing. Like, the amount of times I've looked at that front door and just thought, I'm fucking moving to Mexico. I'm going to Mexico. I'm changing my name. I'm going to find one of those Better Call Saul motherfuckers and get a new passport. I'm done. And the amount of times that I thought, I couldn't be prouder. I don't want to be anywhere other than here, yeah, watching my kids being amazing. I can't wait for the day that I have two grown women come around my house for Christmas dinner telling me about their lives and the amazing things that they're doing. Mm, yeah. I can't wait for that fucking day.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And I'm getting closer every day.
Yeah.
My eldest is an unbelievable athlete. She runs for Victoria Park Harriers. She embarrasses boys every weekend. Because she's so tall. Her stride is incredible. And her natural ability as an athlete is unreal. I've never been good at sports, you know. I don't know where the fuck she gets it from, but she's amazing. And she wants to be in the Olympics, and I believe she can do it. And even if she doesn't do it, I know she'll be able to put her mind to something else because I've given her the right start, and her mum's given her the right start. Mm. And that sense of achievement, it's fucking great. That's why I can walk out of an audition and then my agent's like, you didn't get it. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. I can step off a stage. She's like, oh, that went quite badly. I'm like, yeah, but mate, I got paid before I stepped on the stage, man. I got some girls at home that love the shit out of me. I don't give a fuck if you didn't find me funny.
Yeah.
You know? People don't understand the lion strength that I've got from having children.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's great, man.
The day I come home and my kids are like, you're a piece of shit.
Yeah.
That's when I'm fucked. That's when I got nothing.
That's when you go to Mexico.
Yeah. That's when I go to Mexico for real.
Thank you, everyone. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks in particular to Ben Bailey-Smith, obviously, Doc Brown, Jamie. Obviously, you know, your input is always welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. I appreciate
High
that.
Praise.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of good that you're sort of there, I guess.
Making up the numbers. Nice.
I didn't mean it like that.
Okay.
So thanks everyone for listening and tune in again next time.
Yeah, and also remember to rate, review, share, subscribe, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, @GoodDadUgly, all that shit.
All that shit, 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 all that shit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.